Hello and welcome to the Vassals of Kingsgrave. Today we will be discussing FX's hit miniseries, ? Shogun, based on James Clavell's novel. My name is Michal. I am hosting today, and I am I think on the Discord is Inkazrain, although I honestly don't know because I had to change it for certain things, and I don't know, Discord's weird. I'm joined today by Bina007.
Hello, everyone.
And by Matt. Cool. So I'm really happy that we are getting to discuss the show because it rocked. And it was really, I found it to be a very cool cultural moment to kind of be following it in real time. Although I'm sure that it will be very gratifying to binge as well. So let's start off to do what we do. How many, I don't know, sticks of time, questionable tonsures? Bina, how many would you give?
All the lemon cakes from me. It was a slow start, and I have to say, as someone who hadn't read the book, I did find the first couple of episodes tough. But by the end, I just thought I think I said to my husband, it's the best TV standalone one-off seasons I've seen since Chernobyl, which for me is high praise indeed, because I think Chernobyl is kind of like the peak of peakers TV. I really thoroughly enjoyed it.
Nice. I have to agree. I think it's pretty dramatically unassailable. I'd give it a 5 of whatever. I mean, it's so well crafted that I just find it really fascinating. All right, so I, like Bina, have not read the book, but Matt, you have read the book, so not to put you on the spot, but is there any, like, what was your experience like having read the book?
So yeah, no, I mean, this was a great experience, and it's a fantastic adaptation. The various changes were fairly predictable. As I was saying, the first episode, as Bina was talking about, yeah, it is a little slow just because they have to, like, condense this, you know, opening 300-page section that's pretty much just, like, all Blackthorn. It's like one of those classic, you know, slowly easing you into the world introductions, and frankly, there's a lot more suffering and torture that, you know, is nice for them to just kind of cut out of there. So, you know, they get all that out of the way within the first episode while introducing, you know, kind of all the major players, with especially the main three. Just overall, I mean, the two sections that they really needed to nail for me, for this to be like a 5 out of 5, is one, the Pleasure House sequence in episode 6, and then two, the entirety of episode 9. Like, those are like the two most exciting aspects of the book, and they fucking nailed it.
That's really in fact cool. My favorite episodes. So even as a non-book reader, I got them. They conveyed to me that those were the dramatic heights. So I guess it's working. So basically, does the book start out with 300 pages of getting out of the Shire? Is that what you're trying to tell us?
Yeah, pretty much. Like, he's just kind of like stuck in Enduro for like most of that. So
good to know. Forewarned is forearmed.
Yeah. I found the pilot really kind of striking, I think, in that, like, you know, they were very clearly going for the, like, you're a barbarian. No, you're a barbarian. You know, like, almost like savages from Pocahontas, like that song a little bit. But like, it really worked for me because, like, there was one moment, I can't remember exactly what it was, but like, it was some interaction with Omi and the soldiers versus, you know, Blackthorn and the sailors, that, like, I was like, man, like, reality is just different for these two groups of people, like, more so maybe even than another culture that they would come into contact with, that each of them would come into contact with. And that was kind of one of my favorite things about the show, that, like, it really, to me, felt like a way of understanding cultures coming into contact, you know, and from both of their perspectives, where, like, they were very much both like, who the hell is this? You know, like, what the hell's going on? You know, I feel like usually you either get that from the invader's perspective, probably more commonly, or you get it occasionally from the native population. You know, I don't know. I felt that was very cleverly done, and a good way of illustrating, frankly, like, you know, so as someone who had never heard of Shogun, but has a little bit of an obsession with, like, 16th and 17th century Europe and England in particular, every time, like, the violence and the, you know, torture and the whatever of the Japanese is kind of portrayed, it's like, it's shocking. But then it's also like, I mean, they're not doing dissimilar things back in England, you know, like the queen is the daughter of a king who murdered two of his wives, you know, hanging, drawing and quartering is a regular feature. So I just found it like very interesting to think about both sides of that.
Yeah, and we all hate treacherous Catholics too. So
yeah, exactly, right.
The only difference, and maybe we can get into this at some point, is seppuku. Like, I found the final episode in particular very difficult. In fairness, I find the whole thing difficult. This won me over in spite of myself because I find that culture, that particular cultural aspect of the sort of the honor and therefore honorable suicide very hard to stomach, which may be my own narrow-mindedness. But yeah, I found that very, very tricky.
Yeah, I mean, well, I think the first time we see it is like the least palatable it could possibly be, right? You know, like it's the, I mean, Fuji is my favorite character, and I keep wanting to like go back and watch her initial scenes before I knew how awesome she was. But like, I can't because there's like a little baby in them that is about to be murdered. Like, it's just too harrowing. So I think that is a very interesting kind of way of introducing us to this. And it is actually not through anyone else's eyes, right? It's through the Japanese eyes. But yeah, as I don't know, as we should definitely come back and talk about that because it's a very interesting arc, I think, from like Fuji's husband and Fuji's son being murdered basically to Blackthorn's willingness.
Episode 10. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And in a way, maybe like his finally becoming part of the culture. And,
yeah.
You know, anyway, let's get to episode 10 when we get to episode 10. But yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, so I guess anything else stand out about the pilot that people were taking for? I was just thrilled to see Nestor Carbonell also. Like, I thought he was fantastic.
Yeah, so good. I mean, just the color palette, just, you know, I am old enough that I remember, like, I don't know if it was originals or reruns of the Richard Chamberlain Shogun on TV, which was so colorful. To my young eyes, and just seeing the tone with which they, I mean, it's always gray, it's always misty rain, it's always dark and gloomy. And just even in episode one, just seeing the way in which they were going to shoot it, like the budget on Shohei. I don't know if you guys know like how much this cost or what Disney put into it. And you said it's a hit. Is it a hit from a streaming standpoint? Because this must have cost a fortune to film. But it's all on screen. I mean, this is the most beautiful thing I've seen on screen that's quote-unquote a TV show for quite some time.
Yeah, no, seriously. And I actually recommend the costume designer, Carlos something. I'll look it up. But he is on Instagram, like, talking about, like, you know, each costume and the thought that went into it. And it's really an extraordinary, you know, portrayal. And I think part of that also is, like, the stuff that doesn't, well, I mean, I guess maybe there's consultants to pay and stuff, but the stuff that doesn't necessarily cost money, but is so cut off a lot of the time in historical epics and historical shows, but like the cultural knowledge, and like it doesn't stop. Like, it's, you know, the way people move, you know, the way people sit in like, it just in the scene where Torunaga goes into you know, the council. And like down to the way they like go to the floor, you know, and where they position themselves in the room and the angle to which people are bowing and the way servants come into and enter rooms. Like, you see multiple times servants like backing out of rooms very, you know, in a almost completely like crouched position. Yeah, I found that attention to cultural detail just like so incredibly immersive. And like, you know, it's both strange, obviously, to my eyes that I'm not used to seeing that. But at the same time, like, it feels completely right. And it feels like a way of kind of entering into this culture, like, fully, because you have no other choice other than to observe and understand, you know?
Yeah, the way Mariko and the rest of the women just kind of like walk. Like, I'm curious, like, how much practice that took. I thought that was very striking. And yeah, in terms of kind of like the opening two pilot episodes, the initial meeting between the three of them was just very crackling for me, and just a good kind of like energy build from the initial two.
I think it shows a lot of maturity on the part of the showrunners slash screenwriters that they were willing to patiently build on those first two episodes, because they could have lost people. They could have lost people like me, right? I mean, I only stayed because it looked amazing and gorgeous and because you guys were saying this is really true to the books. And just looking through their Wikipedia pages, it doesn't feel like they did anything before this. Like the guy did Top Gun Maverick. I mean, it just feels like a remarkable achievement for people who are effectively unproven, or I don't know.
Yeah, well, Rachel Kondo is a prose writer primarily. Like she publishes like stories, which I find remarkable. That, you know, I think you can see that kind of literary influence in the storytelling and just the willingness to kind of let things percolate. You know, obviously not to say that people who are trained in screenwriting, like, you know, can't do that, because obviously they can, and do wonderfully. But I felt that influence very strongly. There's a poetry to the way the show plays out, and I think each scene even that is just like incredible. So moving past the first two episodes, although I will say the scene where Toranaga and Blackthorn first meet and are talking, and I think it's Father Alvito who's translating at that point, and then they cut out Alvito and you just go to, you know, Toranaga speaking in Japanese and Blackthorn answering in English or Portuguese, I guess. I found that so effective. That was just like, because it's such an intense scene and it is an interrogation, losing the translator at that point felt like it you know, ratcheted the stakes up, you know, super, super high.
Yeah, they do the same thing in the Pleasure House sequence too.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. Oh, and also, okay, I will say, Yabushige kind of won me over by episode 9, which was too late, obviously. But the whole time when people were like, oh, Yabushige is such a bro, I love this guy, I'm like, he boiled a man alive.
Yeah, no, and it's worse. Like, it's worse in the book.
Yeah? Oh, like, my God.
There's more, like, I mean, that's, the boiling alive is the big thing that he does, but like, just overall, like, you're just like with him and like his like violence for like longer at the set of the book. So yeah, that was one of the changes for me in general, where it's just like I liked him in this show. Entertaining to me.
Yeah, if I have a criticism, it might be that I think they lost some of his initial like psychopathy or sadism that like felt, you know, like it had was established pretty early on when he's like, oh yeah, do it in my ordinary way, like my normal way, you know. Yeah. Like, and then kind of that, you know, he's still kind of a death obsessed person, but he's less like, oh, let me study this person's death and like enact suffering for my own gratification.
I think that's a strength, isn't it? I mean, by the final couple of episodes, I mean, when he's sort of like, you know, drunkenly on the boat, I mean, I felt real sympathy for him.
Oh yes, definitely.
You know, he's been on a journey, and so presumably he wasn't a psychopath at the beginning, because that maybe makes it worse, that he did have some capacity for growth, or we grew to have empathy for him. I mean, he's such a complicated character, as is Fuji. I think some of these characters who you could see as the second tier characters actually ended up being the most intriguing to me. I was like, I want to read the books. I want to know more about them, which I think is, again, such a triumph of the show.
Yeah, no, I definitely agree. I think I just felt like he was almost a little bit too likable through like kind of the central episodes where he's, you know, he becomes almost like comic relief, and he does so extremely like successfully. Like he was delightful. Like when Mariko, you know, pronounces her poem and he's like, who talks about bare branches? It's spring, you know, there's just whatever. Yeah. But he was certainly a highlight to watch. All right, so moving forward into, sorry, I'm on the Wikipedia because the show has been airing weekly for like 10 weeks, so I don't remember everything that happened. Oh yeah, episode 3 is like the harbor escape, the introduction of Buntaro.
Oh boy.
So do we want to talk about
an apparent goodbye to Buntaro as well?
Yeah, yeah.
some of us thought he was gone.
We hardly knew. Oops.
I think that's what some of the people like me wanted. That's what we thought the show was going to be, like action samurai. Yeah, you know, yeah. It was so flipping well done. I felt I'd earned it. And maybe that was the point. I thought I'd earned a good set of like tense action escapades. So yeah, man, I was here for it.
Yeah, no, that was really fun. It is also our farewell to Nestor Carbonell as what's-his-face? Rodriguez? Yeah, Rodriguez. But yeah, I feel like that episode I had a little bit of like the Long Night syndrome where the escape happens in the dark. And I was like, I can't kind of see everything that's going on right now, but you know, it's okay. But yeah, I agree. It's a very like interesting kind of action explosion. And then, you know, we have this like weird Buntaro guy who like right away we do not like because he's mean to Marco. And then he has this moment of honor that you're like, oh, okay, cool. I guess the beginning and end of his story was mean guy to honorable guy really fast. And yeah. Oh, right. That's also, sorry. That's the episode where we have Blackthorn fake freak out to cover Torunaga's escape in the litter, which was hilarious. And I appreciate it, especially since like that courtyard in particular becomes the site of a lot of very dark stuff. Like that particular escape was I think a nice prelude to that.
Yeah, this is like the one, yeah, this is the one thing that Buntaro is good at. It's kind of like why he is he has earned the respect of his peers, just because he is excellent in battle and terrible everywhere else. but yeah, no, I thought they really did that sequence really well with kind of his defense and escape and Torunaga acknowledging him. And yet there, I guess, yeah, the one maybe the issue with kind of the escape is they jump around a little bit and they don't show you kind of the path and the topography like as well as they possibly could for you to really like track like where they're moving throughout the castle and the city. But that's really kind of a minor complaint. And just the interaction between Torunaga and his wives is always an entertaining sequence, because they're kind of the few people that can give him shit and really kind of have a good rapport with him.
Yeah. And that, I mean, honestly, the introduction of the consort, who remains a minor character through the whole story, but like to me, and maybe for Blackthorn, like that was just an interesting point of view on like legitimacy, and is obviously important when it comes to the heir. The idea that like consorts' children are equally, you know, as legitimate, I guess, as children of wives, and they're kind of considered like our children as a family unit.
Yeah.
It was unclear to me actually who Nagakato's mother was. I couldn't tell if that was Kiri's son, but it didn't kind of.
Interesting. I actually don't know that off the top of my head.
Epic fail son Nagakato, RIP. but we'll get there. Episode 4, sorry, not to go too, you know, granular, but you know, I like this kind of the show moves in a very deliberate way, so I think it's interesting to talk about it that way. Episode 4 is the Eightfold Fence, where we have obviously, you know, the very important speech of Mariko kind of like starting to break Blackthorn into the concept of how the society works and how these people view their reality. And that idea of kind of like the internal personal reality and the external, which has kind of been mirrored in like, you know, Torunaga talking to his son about like, you're thinking about friends and enemies, but you only have yourself, and the like, everyone has three hearts and their secret heart. You know, so there's a lot of different like levels of reality that the show is playing with in general. I think Nagakato Failson's shining moment, where we get the cannon demonstration and then Omi straight up manipulates him into firing on Ishido's guy. And that was pretty gory. There were a lot of bits hanging out.
Yeah, that was a surprisingly like visceral scene, and seeing him like lying there on the ground like without any legs, just still yelling up at everyone.
Yeah, his arm is just like off
It's certainly a fucking image.
Yeah. And it's interesting, too, because this is the only time the canons actually come into play. I guess I should have said that there's spoilers, but whatever. It's an interesting, like, I think there are kind of a lot of red hair, like action red herrings in the show. And obviously it kind of culminates in a huge action red herring. But this is an interesting prelude to that, where it's like, okay, so this is Blackthorne's role, and he's gonna, you know, teach them. He's Hatsumoto, and, you know, and all that. And then what it comes down to is just a fairly silly boy, basically, like, taking revenge in a way that he shouldn't, but thinks he should.
Yeah, no, that's always an interesting, because, yeah, no, it's the same in the book where, you know, and even at the end, like, you know, you don't, similarly, you never actually, you know, see the battles occur. You know, the book just kind of cuts off once Torinaga has gained his advantage, and you don't really see the outcome of that, of the armies all clashing and Blackthorne. And this episode brings up kind of a historical siege that would be comparable to, basically, you could use, you know, his ship or a collection of ships as like a way to siege and assault Osaka Castle, that never actually, you know, comes into play in the story, even though it'd be a relevant military tactic. So yeah, it's an interesting juxtaposition, but, you know, everything is more just character base and tactical wheeling and dealing rather than outright fighting.
Yeah. Oh, and of course this episode is where we get Fuji's, like,
Yes, this is the, like, really, like, where Fuji comes on, turns it up.
Please be on your way. She's so great. I love her so much.
Yeah, and so overall, this was the biggest surprise of the show for me was Fuji. Like, she's just an infinitely better character in this show than she is in the book. Like, yeah, sorry to disappoint, because, like, when you go and read it, like, you're not gonna get as much as you get in the show in terms of her actions and her wonderful reaction shots.
Oh, she's so good. Apparently also, like, the actress was, like, terrified the whole time. Like, she's done some interviews where she was like, yeah, I didn't know what I was doing. I thought I was being horrible. And it's like, no, you're incredible.
Yeah, because, like, the interviews that I heard with, like, some of the writers or whatever, where it's like, basically they would save all her reaction shots, like, to the end of the day, is just kind of a nice, like, come down from all the serious stuff, and frankly, that she would nail them in, like, you know, very few takes.
Yeah, she's definitely someone I hope to see more of. I don't think she speaks English that well, so I'm not sure if we'll get her in the English speaking world too soon. But I don't know. She's fantastic. I really hope to see more of her. But yeah. Also, of course, in this episode, Blackthorne and Mariko get it on, which felt very gratifying, I think, even though they kind of do that thing where, like, you assume it's Mariko, and then she's like, oh, Blackthorne's in such a good mood this morning. And she's like, oh, the courtesan we sent to you, you know, you enjoyed, blah, blah, blah. Yeah, it's funny because the show, like, really goes back and forth between, like, not funny and not amusing, but, like, somehow much lighter feeling events and then, like, much darker feeling events. Like, you know, we have that exchange, and then, like, Nakato blows up, you know, Jozen and the army, and it ends on, like, carnage and, you know, the, like, this will be war. And actually the next episode is a lot like that. Because it kind of, when Buntaro returns, I felt like, you know, the whole scene at their house, actually Fuji's house, let's be real, it's Fuji's house. that whole dinner with Blackthorne and Buntaro getting increasingly drunk.
Do you all think Buntaro is in love with Mariko?
Deeply.
I think so. I think he turned out to be, for me, the most tragic character in this whole show. My heart went out for him. Like, he doesn't understand her and what she needs to do for the sake of her family, but he's keeping her alive because he's in love with her. I think it's just, so dramatically potent.
And I mean, it's a really, you get so little with them, but you get so much at the same time. Like, just the arrow shooting scene is, like, so encapsulating, you know, of this, like, kind of I don't know how you would put it, just like captured passion on his part that kind of comes out in violence. And like, there's obviously no excuse for that. Like he's a wife beater and that's awful. But like, you do get that idea that he, you know, first of all, you know that Mariko, who we haven't spoken as much about, like, she has his number completely. And like, I think she knows exactly how he's going to react pretty much anytime she does anything. And I don't think she expects him to grant her death, you know, but she keeps trying for it. But yeah, the idea of Buntaro as this guy who is like ultimately, I heard him described on one of the podcasts as like an artist at heart, but also fundamentally an artist of war, which is a really interesting kind of, I think that duality that he is, because he has conversations where he seems so like canny and quiet and like artistic, you know, and then he's like beating Mariko and he's like, you know, what is the line that he tells Blackthorn, like when Blackthorn asks, like he's trying to make an effort and he's like, oh, how'd you escape or whatever, and he's like, stories are for children and heroes are for the dead or something like that.
Yeah,
I'm butchering it, but it was a great line,
right? Yeah, speaking of that, just because like even though he did make it back alive, like it's basically just because, you know, he had some people to help them and literally they all died. So it's just kind of like 14 people dying to protect one. And so, yeah, so that's like, you know, these stories really aren't as heroic as you might think. And yeah, this, I mean, the whole dinner sequence is kind of another, you know, major climactic moment, happens about halfway through the book. And I really, really thought they nailed it here. And I think it's telling with Mariko and her understanding of Buntaro. I think he only tells her to like choose a post and she immediately knows what's about to happen. She's explained to Angie, it's like, just choose a post outside that he's going to hit. She stands there. She knows that the arrow is going to go right by her face. She doesn't move. Like everything is just, it's clearly a scene that is played out before. And she, you know, just reacts instantaneously. As you were saying, with kind of with her control and wanting death, I don't know how clear they made in the show, but there are various points, you know, throughout their marriage where she's specifically tried to, you know, when she sees an opportunity like this one, you know, she goes and she pushes him in order to try and get him to kill her, essentially, to agree to allow her to die. And this was kind of like one of those moments where, you know, she was somewhat needling him purposefully to try and attain that effect.
Yeah, it's a lot. And then, like, you know, I feel like the way she reacts to Blackthorn seeing that she's been beaten is like very contrary to how I would assume someone would react, which is like kind of gratification and like, this is real or whatever, but it's like incredibly shameful for her. Yeah, that people know that this is happening. Yeah, as a character who like is all about control, I think like that it's an interesting kind of moment. Also in this episode, a couple of great things. I think this might have been my favorite episode to watch, even though it was like horrifying, when Toranaga comes back and then he's like talking to Yabushige and he's like, yeah, I'm super glad that my son did this because like this rocks. This like kicked it off. So now they have to come fight us. And it's like, I feel like that was one of my first indications that like this guy is not maybe not the hero we wanted, but maybe the hero we deserve. If that makes any sense. Like there's a distinct coldness, and you know, not just that this guy Josen has been killed, but that like his son has been manipulated into doing that, and he knows it's Omi, right? Like he rewards Omi for that. Also in Broken to the Fist, of course, we get the pheasant incident. Touch and die. Great. That's great. I don't know. Any thoughts on that particular event?
Yeah, no, I mean, the gardener sequence overall is, you know, it's another kind of important, it's an important, there's better words for this, but it's an important like learning moment for Blackthorn. And it's kind of very meaningful in his kind of development and shift from one culture to the other. You know, it leads to some good kind of introspective scenes of kind of him just, you know, almost meditating in the garden. And I mean, he I don't think they mentioned this in the show, but, you know, he essentially, like, he names that stone after the gardener. It's just like, this is Uchiha's stone now. And it's kind of like a calming presence for him. As he's trying to just survive in all this and bumble his way through. And, you know, it's a way for him to almost meditate and trying to think things through and come to terms with his situation and how he's going to proceed going forward. It's another thing where it's, you know, it's this really, like, tragic and terrible death, and yet there is some beauty at the end of it.
And, you know, the way Mariko talks about it, like, it's so ice cold about, like, oh, that was a better death than he could have expected otherwise, like, he was just an old man. And, like, which is interesting because I think that is, like, somewhat shades of the classism that, like, is referenced through the show, but I don't think ever confronted, which they're confronting a lot of things, so I get it. You know, and there's that moment in the previous episode where he refers to the guy as Sama, and they're both like, no, not Sama. Like, it's not appropriate. He's too low for that. You know, that was, yeah, quite striking. But then at the same time, when another ice cold Torunaga moment is when he's, you know, he's telling his undercover samurai friend to, like, find another spy. And, like, you know what's going to happen to that other, to that scapegoated innocent person, right? So the fact that the gardener has died and has been killed in this way does actually save someone else from a truly horrible death, unbeknownst to anyone except this samurai. But, like, that is, I think, a factor that you have to consider when you weigh, like, the pointlessness, I guess, of his death, right?
Yeah. Is this the episode where we get Mariko's, like, speech of, like, life and death, they are the same, and Blackthorn's like, oh, well, only one is permanent, for fuck's sakes.
No, I think that's when she's talking about seppuku herself, I think. But yeah, so it's
towards the end. Yeah.
Yeah. And this is also an interesting turn for the Blackthorn-Mariko relationship, right? Because, like, they were so, I mean, literally so close, you know, and then suddenly it's like this, you know, they're almost like enemies. Like, she does that, like, the only words that will pass between us are other people's. And I'm like, well, that's not true because his words are his own, you know, but whatever.
Right, yeah, it lasts all about 5 minutes, but sure.
Yeah, exactly. And you also get Torunaga being like, what, like, why are you guys acting like teenagers? Like, what is going on? And then, you know, talking about the translation issue, that moment where Blackthorn is, like, ranting about how the gardener was killed for no reason, and Torunaga is like, why is he upset? And she's like, an issue with his gardener.
That's the meme. That is, I was wondering, I couldn't remember which episode that came from, but that is the meme, which is just fucking fantastic.
Yeah, it's really, I mean, the ability to boil things down in a particular way is just exceptional. But I think also, I mean, it makes Mariko less likable, which is a good thing, you know? Like, she's a very admirable character in so many ways, and obviously the female lead and the protagonist of this show, and, like, to have her be very unsympathetic to a lot of these things is, I don't know, I think reasonable, and a good character wrinkle. We also have the earthquake. I was convinced 100% that Fuji was going to die in the earthquake because...
Yeah, they actually, well, obviously she still lives throughout the rest of the story, but yeah, her injuries are a lot worse in the book, and it kind of, like, takes her out of the story just because she can't walk, her legs get, like, badly burned. And so, yeah, so, like, she can't walk for like the majority of, like, the rest of the novel. So it's like, I was like, yeah, they needed to tone that down to, like, keep her involved in kind of where she needed to be in the story. So I was happy for that.
Yeah. So then episode 6, Ladies of the Willow World. Ladies of the Willow World is a pretty chill action-wise episode. is kind of primarily spent kind of interrogating the world of, you know, geisha and that experience. I think probably my favorite scene was the negotiation for That was fantastic. And of course, this is also the introduction of Ochiba and her past with Mariko. I found Ochiba, who I guess makes her debut at the end of the last episode, terrifying, like bone chilling. She just seemed like a villain out of like Disney to the 1000th degree, you know, like just utterly, she didn't even do anything, but just the way she spoke, like just like, this is how things are going to be now, you know, and like utterly like ruthless in that way. So then to get her like extremely empathizing, whatever, backstory was really fascinating to me.
Yeah, basically, Ochiba is pretty much one of the only people that can actually like match Torinaga in terms of just like intelligence and tactical acumen and just kind of that pure like cold iron personality that's kind of needed for for this level of strategy. Overall, I think there were, for me, there were three characters that kind of were elevated by this show from the novel, and obviously Fuchi's at the top of that, and then the other two were Yabu and Ochiba. Or just like you get to see more of Ochiba in this, you know, rather than just the pure villain aspect of it, mm-hmm. or antagonist, I guess is a better word. But yeah, just kind of her more, just her deeper connection with Mariko and how that's, you know, how that's shaped events and shapes the end of end of the story. They also took out the subplot of the heir's parentage because it was, you know, it's unnecessary.
Yeah. That wasn't really a question that I had. It was more just like she went through a lot, you know, and it frankly, the heir becomes so irrelevant to like exactly. The actual politics. And I mean, looking at the history, like he lives a couple more years, but like I think is killed by one of Torinaga's sons or something, one of his heirs. Tokugawa. Yeah. It was a real way of like you start everything kind of like with the focus like pinned on the man, and then the story like really expertly like shifts to the female perspective. This is also the episode where we get, I think, the line of, you know, a man can go to war for many reasons, but a woman is just always at war. Yeah. Which is like, yeah. Yeah, and then of course we have the threat of Crimson Sky that we don't really know what it is, but it's this plan to attack Osaka, and
I was a little bit annoyed. I just want to say that my team just won, so it's all cool, I'm back.
Ah, congratulations.
I just want to add on Willow World that the director got them to watch Wong Kar-wai's In the Mood for Love, which I was very pleased to hear about, because as I was watching, I was like, this is the most fucking sexy thing I've ever seen since In the Mood for Love. I also want to say that North London is red. And I finally want to say the only moment I genuinely hated this show is when I realized that Crimson Sky, Crimson Tide, whatever, was not going to be some badass motherfucking like shogun samurai battle, but it was going to be wily and subtle. And of course, I love that it was wily and subtle and it was actually Mariko, but and in the moment, I was like, you mean we're not having a battle? That's episode 9? That like the big thing is not a battle? So I felt very superficial in that moment. Thank you.
Yep. No, I hear that. And congratulations. I'm glad.
Thank you.
I don't know what any of those words mean, but congratulations. I think it's also worth talking about Hiramatsu for a second here, because he is, you know, an important character who gets, you know, used to particular purposes soon after. There were a lot of scenes in this episode, or, you know, obviously it's a very sexy episode. It is, you know, and I'm still like, did Blackthorn and Kiku have sex? Did they? Or like,
I mean, they do, but yeah.
Yeah.
It's not important, but they do.
Okay. And then her goodbye to him is like, is that like formula or is that like legit? You know, she's like, I would count the minutes till I see you.
No, that's like, yeah, no, it's actually, she basically gives him kind of a very, I mean, that type of farewell is, you know, that doesn't always happen, but she gives him essentially a very honorable farewell when he leaves, that is notable to the people who witness it.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess we can transition into, unless anyone wants to say anything else about Ladies of the Willow World.
Well, I just have to comment of, because they changed that whole sequence up technically in terms of just like the dialogue and how Mariko and Blackthorn and Kiku all interact. But I mean, it's breathtaking when she shifts next to Mariko and the camera shifts to hide her and the translation falls away and Mariko switches to I, and it's mm-hmm. it's just all it was. I don't know if there will be a better scene that I watch this year than that.
Yeah.
In terms of sexual tension, I don't think there's a better scene you'll watch this decade. I mean, that was, it was phenomenal. And that's my point about, I'd never heard of these showrunners before, but this the kind of the literacy they have, cinema literacy, to put together, the way they use the edits, the way they use the camera position, the way they inform the actors and gave them context. I think it's phenomenal. I hope this gets like Emmys a go-go, right? I mean
it will just because it gets to compete in the miniseries.
Legitimately, because a lot of people game that, right? Oh, let's put beef in miniseries. No, let's just announce the sequel a moment after the Emmys, right? I hate how that category is going.
Yeah.
Like, even if they're doing a season two, which they shouldn't, they'll never announce it till after the Emmys, right?
Yeah, yeah, I don't think they will. I mean, the showrunner certainly won't.
I don't know that I agree, but I don't think it will be like a straight sequel. I don't think they'll be like picking up with Blackthorn and Toranaga. I think that if they do something, it will be in the Japanese storytelling realm, but I don't think it will be like with these characters. And, you know, it might be another James Clavell novel, or it might be, you know, a story that they, you know, there's obviously a ton of historical drama to fictionalize.
Sure.
So I agree that like I don't want more like of this Shogun, but I do want more of these showrunners dealing with these themes and like characters like this. I would love for them to do kind of, the only thing that I felt was overlooked really was the lower class people. You know, like everybody we know is upper class except for poor Gardner, who literally dies for being lower class. That's my take on that. But yeah, I agree. They're not going to tip their hand before they're doing the, like, if we have a good idea, we'll do something, which is like, I feel like in the dictionary under, like, we're in negotiations with the studio. Cause we made y'all a lot of money. So, chapter 7, episode 7, Stick of Time starts with the flashback to Toranaga's first victory. It is suitably quite bloody, and it is the first time we actually see seppuku occur on screen.
That was brutal. That was absolutely brutal. I don't know what you guys were expecting or whether in the books it's described that kind of viscerally, literally viscerally, but I don't think I've ever seen anything that brutal on screen.
Yeah. I mean, no matter, not that I remember it that well, but yeah, no matter how they describe it, like it's not gonna be as effective as seeing it. And yeah, I was always curious how they were gonna do this. I think they cut away a little bit on this one. They showed a little more for Kurematsu, I believe, if I'm remembering.
I definitely saw bowel loops in this scene.
I'm not sure I have much to say on it. You know, there's a few interviews I've heard. I've only listened to the Ringer ones with Joe. I haven't listened to kind of the official podcast stuff. I think in those interviews I heard, I think they do a good job of kind of, you know, explaining their thoughts on the matter and how delicate and careful and frankly afraid they were of dealing with this topic. And we can discuss in episode 10 too, that scene with Blackthorn happens like halfway through the book. they moved it to the end because they're like, we cannot deal with this here at this point in the show.
Yeah, and I just from a storytelling perspective, like it's really, I mean, I don't blame them for being, you know, a little nervous about it, because like, I mean, any Western storytelling thing, you know, attempt to tell like a non-Western story usually has those like, you know, oh, this other culture is involved with death in a way that we find both, you know, lurid and like sensational and also like morally bad. So like the idea of samurai and the idea of seppuku is obviously something that like I think has been kind of, I don't know, fetishized a little bit. But the way they do it, like introducing the concept so early, but not showing us anything of it, you know, with Fuji's husband. And then like this is the first time we see somebody actually commit seppuku. And it's six episodes later. So I think like that is, and the first time, well, we're about to see it quite a bit, it's someone we don't know. You know, we have no emotional investment in this, and we don't even really have an emotional investment in, you know, young Toranaga, because, you know, we've never seen young Toranaga before. So like its relevance is kind of more about the conversation that he and Hiramatsu have later, when we learn that the seppuku part was not the worst part of this man's death, which they also don't show us. But I think just that progression of that, of like almost like frog in the bathwater, like, you know, the boiling pot, like, you know, like teaching us how to understand this, you know, whether or not we like morally agree with it or whatever, like teaching us how to reckon with this as something that people do and are willing to do in what it looks like and what it feels like to watch it, I think was really absolutely masterful, because it takes all of the sexiness, whatever, bad word, but you know what I mean, out of the prospect. We also have a wild scene where Buntaro tries to get one over on Mariko by going to Toranaga and being like, Anjin slept with my wife. and Toranaga's like, cool, so you have to kill both of them. and Mariko in that scene is just like such an enigma to me, because it's like, it's so, you know, on the one hand, it's like exactly what she wants, right? And her response is like, you know, my life is my husband's to take, like, whatever. It's not, you know, has nothing to do with me. But at the same time, you know, there is something shocking about it. And the fact that it's connected to Blackthorn and not anything else, you know, that her life might end that way, I think is really fascinating, and really kind of maybe not how she envisioned things going. Yeah, I think that's the point where Buntaro is actually defeated as far as like his little war with Blackthorn. I think like Toranaga putting him in that corner, I think shows him that he can't do anything else, you know, because from then on he's very much like, he does the tea thing and he's like trying to reconnect with Mariko in like an actual human way, as opposed to like a property kind of way, but it's not gonna work. Yeah, and this is Fail Sons. Okay, seriously, right? Like I found it quite moving on first watch. I only watched it once, but after thinking about it, the scene where the brother kind of reveals his villainy and is like, you know, and hands the son the order to commit seppuku, and Toranaga is like screaming, like, don't do it, you know, don't accept it. And on the one hand, you could read that as like fatherly concern. On the other hand, it's like, if you commit seppuku, there's no, I don't get anything from that, you know?
Yeah. It's not that, yeah, it's exactly, it's so self-interested. And, you know, I said to you, Matt, when the series ended, does Toranaga do it for power or for Japan? And you were like, both. I mean, but the man is like stone cold, stone cold. Is he a psychopath or is he just very, very fucking clever? Maybe both.
Yeah, I mean, he's just he's just cold. Like he's just like the purest of cold iron to me. I don't know if that verges into psychopath or not.
He sacrifices his best mate Consigliere. Oh, I'll have another son, Mariko. Oh, I don't know.
Yeah,
for me, it was more about like, I mean, again, like I'll say what I said on the thread, which is that like, I started off thinking that he was like Ned Stark with brains, and then he kind of turned into Tywin Lannister with feelings. And like, to me, like, it's...
What evidence of feelings is there in the entire show other than when he subtly maybe, just maybe a little bit nods at Blackthorn in the final episode?
So I think when he watches Hiramatsu commit seppuku, and then when he tells Mariko about it, he seems genuinely like cut up about it. However, I don't know that like it almost makes it worse a little bit, you know, because it's one thing to be like, you know, you're all just like puppets for me, you know. It's another thing for like for him. It's almost like more condescending because it's like you're my players that I have fostered and built and crafted to come to this moment, you know. Him feeling it almost doesn't make it better for me, other than I guess it makes him like not a psychopath and more of a like just a general created by the times, you know.
Yeah, no, I think he definitely feels the loss of Hiramatsu and Mariko. His son maybe not so much.
Yeah,
just because like he never, you know, he just could never, he always disappointed Torinaga in terms of just his, you know, his mental capacity.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, I mean, does it make it better? No. Like, I, you know, Torinaga is, you know, is one of my favorite characters, but under no circumstance am I here to defend him. He's just impressive and he fucking won.
Yeah. I think the one question I have, and I'm curious how you guys read this, like, was the seppuku with Hiramatsu planned? Did they go? Did they like discuss that before, or was it the type of thing where Hiramatsu is realizing in the moment that this is Torinaga's plan?
Oh, I thought it was planned.
No, it was
not. That could just be my prejudice. I always think Torinaga's like 10 steps ahead of everyone.
Oh, it's planned on Torinaga's part, but I'm saying like, did he and Hiramatsu have a conversation where it was like, "This is what you got to do about it," and he's like, "Yeah, I got you."
Yeah, what I thought, but oh my god, Matt, is that not the case?
It is not. No, it's basically they were basically communicating that to each other while looking at each other in that scene is what was happening.
Oh, how is that not psychopathic?
He's the coldest motherfucker in the world.
Yeah. And I mean, I guess I should note that these are changes. Nagakado and Hiramatsu don't die like this. It's just yeah, it's other people die. It's just that they're just, you know, they're nameless, you know, they're more background characters, so like they don't matter as much. So they changed this just to, number one, have the emotional impact of it, as well as just, you know, basically have Torinaga like kind of have more of a cost to this victory. Then because otherwise then it's just essentially Mariko dying for him, which not the greatest look. So
but also the fact that it's all for optics, it's like they really have to believe that I have lost, so you have to stick a knife into your guts and have your son behead you. Yeah. Like it's astonishing. It's really, it's a level of like diabolical that is sometimes, it is a little difficult to wrap your mind around, I think.
Sure. Yeah, but also kind of, I mean, that's probably the best of Hiroyuki's performance is that scene. So.
Oh my God. So good.
Yeah.
And Buntaro in that scene also is just like, you know, and this is coming on the heels of the tea scene, which is like another thing that like another show wouldn't necessarily do, of like just have these people have a very slow tea ceremony and then talk a while. And then like it culminates in Mariko's, you know, like just shutting him down, you know.
Yeah, he really has like the worst day of his life right there.
It's true.
Just the no good, very bad day, like Jesus.
Exactly. Oh man. And the Anjin's still alive, my goodness. Actually, on that note, just to end off this episode discussion, like Torinaga has that scene at the end, like the whole time he's coughing, and I'm like, you faker, like you son of a bitch, you're not sick. I don't buy this. And then like he has that, you know, conversation at the funeral post, which he doesn't attend, and like, you know, thank you for the time that you gave me, and I won't waste it. And that like does that happen in the book?
I can't remember if well I mean him faking sick, sure, but like specifically him going to the burial plot, I don't know.
Almost felt a little bit too like wanting us to feel like he had feelings. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, that's fair. Because the other main thing is, like, you get Torunaga's perspective exactly one time, and it's at the very end of the book, and it's essentially the speech he gives to Yabushige in the finale. They had him say it out loud just because it's all internal monologue in the book. But like that's literally the only time you get it. So everything else is just, you know, an enigma, you know, from various people's perspective.
Mm-hmm. Ooh, all right. So episode 9, Crimson Sky.
Oh boy. This is the red wedding for people who never read Shogun, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's why I was commenting about like reactions or whatever. I was just like, this is going to be, you know, comparable to the reactions of when
I thought this was karma for all the times I was smug about non-book readers.
Yeah,
because I was floored and I didn't know. I'd been off social media. I didn't know. No one warned me. But it was epic. It was everything she deserved. Mm-hmm. I mean, wow. I don't know if it's like that in the books, but.
Oh no! This is pretty much beat for beat. The scene with Ochiba is extra, but obviously that scene was phenomenal. Everything else is pretty much just pure of just like the flight and everyone fighting and you know, Blackthorn, you know, killing like 2 to 3 of the ninja. Got that where he like reaches, you know, kind of like he's listening and then shoots based off the noise and reaches through and like grabs the guy to like finish him off. Like, oh my god. It's so good.
It's like it's astonishing the way it plays out, and like, yeah, it's really incredible storytelling. I'm mad at myself because I did, like, when the show was starting and I didn't care about any of the characters yet, I did like skim the historical, like, the Wikipedia. Mm-hmm. So I saw the year of the Mariko character's death. So I wasn't surprised, but the way it happened, that was surprising because I thought she was going to commit seppuku. Like, I thought that was just how it was going to play out. And then but then I was also like, in storytelling, right, when you have a character think they want something, right? Like, she thinks she wants death and like so willing to go for that and then being spared. I'm like, the only thing to happen after that is for her to die. Like, that's the only way to go. And like, you know.
But it was the means of it. And I think for someone from a Western culture, the idea of what it signifies in terms of, you know, because she's in her room and there's the other ladies who are there and they don't want to be shamed. And it's the way in which this is going to fell the support from Torunaga's opponent without him going to war. I mean, it's just devastatingly clever. It's so, to me, this is like the ultimate because it's tactically, politically genius. It's emotionally brutal because we know she wants this. But we are also devastated for her that it's going to happen like this. It's everything. It's everything in this episode. And then we have Blackthorn. I mean, I just don't understand how you get more into a scene than is this scene. I'm not sure there was a single culmination scene in all of Game of Thrones that was as good as this in terms of layers and layers of politics and emotion all at once. Normally it's all separated out, isn't it? So I suddenly get that. This is when I got the hype. Like, Willow World, I was like, okay, this is more about cinema than book because it's how it's put together, mm-hmm. or in addition to. But this is when I got the hype for the book and James Clavell. I thought, wow, if this is what he's written, this is really quite something.
Yeah. And it's why I always said that you know, the actress playing Mariko, like, is the linchpin of the show because it's the hardest role. And essentially, I mean, she really is the main character.
Is she like the Meryl Streep of Japan? Does she have form for this? Because it's a stunning performance.
I don't know. The actress who plays Ochiba is very well known and well regarded. But Anna Sawai, I'm honestly not sure.
I mean, if you go to her Wikipedia page, it looks like she's a J-pop star more than anything. Which, if so, is flipping amazing.
Yeah. She did do Pachinko here, which I still have not watched.
Pachinko's great.
Yeah.
I live in fear that Pachinko's going to get cancelled because I don't think it really got the buzz it warrants.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, there we are.
Yeah. Just to say, like, I think that the, I mean, first of all, the, the fact that Blackthorne steps up to second Margo is like,
oof.
Is that one of the show of love?
I mean,
it might be.
Yeah.
Oh. Yeah.
Another change too. In the book, she just orders Yabu to do it for her, and he's like, "All right, cool." yeah, that's. I mean, that's. You know, this is why this adaptation succeeds so much is just because like the changes they've all done is just you know, it all just heightens the emotional like stakes and just kind of the powerful nature of it. It's astounding.
Yeah. And I just want to say about the finale, like, I think that it's such a boss move to have so little happen, you know, like, and just to, because it doesn't even feel like, you know, like the Game of Thrones would be like the aftermath, you know, the episode 9 would be the climax and then 10 would be the aftermath. But this, like, there's nothing coming after this, right? Like, even if they get a season 2, it's not exactly, you know, it's not leading to a season 2. And like, to show us the future, both for Blackthorn, although I know that's debated about whether that's real or not, and also for Tornaga. But you still get that, like, that idea that there's a future for him beyond this, you know? And like, to have it take place in like just that paused, downbeat moment where you know what happened and you know what's coming, and this is just sitting with these people in, you know, between exciting moments, you know? I think really brave, and like props to FX for not, you know, meddling in like the, you know, artistic plans here.
Yeah, everything you just said. It's brave, it's bold, it's elegant, it's because it's so much about interiority, isn't it? I mean, it's about Torunaga's gonna win with a very minor battle. It's all the dominoes are all just gonna fall before him. But to me, it's much more about, we started the pilot episodes kind of from the point of view of Anjan, like not getting this culture at all. And we end with his narrative arc complete, with him immersing himself, acknowledging. I mean, part of that is offering to be the second, I think, to Mariko, is kind of like the acknowledgement that he understands. And when he's speaking to Torunaga kind of without a translator, when there's that moment of acknowledgement and it means everything to him at the end of episode 10, it was so emotionally satisfying. And I suddenly thought, is that the love story? Is the love story actually Anjan and Torunaga? Is that it? I don't know.
I don't know, because I think that if they had continued on from the earthquake, you know, the closeness that they experienced there, then it could have been. But they really kind of shed that, and they don't really interact or have much, you know, togetherness, you know, until this scene. And to me, like, this is so shadowed by the fact that, like, you know, I mean, I had a suspicion that Torunaga, if not blew up the ship himself, knew exactly who had done it. But the fact that he, like, he did it himself, like, you know, and he's still like, no, I'm going to keep killing people in the village. Like, to me, I'm just like, I don't know. You don't need to be friends with this guy.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess, yeah, the two things for me are, yeah, the at least between them, where the, you know, the cost of this for Torunaga, you know, losing both Hiramatsu and Mariko, is that he has, you know, he doesn't have any close confidants left, in terms of all, you know, all those discussions he would have previously.
Yeah, because he sacrificed them.
Right, yeah, with the exception of, you know, of his wife.
Yeah.
So Blackthorn would be one of the only people that could step in to some, you know, not quite the same level, but at least to, you know, approach something like that for him going forward. So like that's a good, you know, parallel. Yeah. And kind of the how I viewed the acknowledgement but between them at the end is that Anjan kind of he pretty much understands exactly like what happened. He's also kind of accepting the fact that he's never going to leave Japan, and I think he's also just kind of somewhat up for the challenge of kind of going forward and how he's kind of gonna.
He clearly is going to leave Japan at some point, right? Because crusty old Anjan at the end.
No, that's just a dream.
So this is a really complicated thing that I didn't pick up on at first.
Yeah.
But like, okay, so the thing is, like, they keep cutting to Mariko's cross in his hand when he's old, right? And then then he puts the cross in the water in the funeral scene.
Yeah.
So I guess it's just, I mean, it's called A Dream of a Dream, the episode. So I guess the implication is that while he was unconscious, this is a dream that he had.
Right. Yeah. And then the, and him going, you know, kind of committing to the seppuku scene, like they show that flash there. You know, my interpretation of it is like, you know, that him going through that is him giving up that, that dream for good. Mm. And there was an interview where the writer specifically stated like him throwing the cross in the water is just to confirm that sequence is just a dream and is not in fact going to come to pass.
Interesting. Okay. So it's interesting because you think that it's when it flashes to old Blackthorn, you think that it's him recollecting these intense moments, but it's actually present Blackthorn recollecting his dream.
Yeah. And I mean, because, yeah, that was always, you know, obviously his goal from the start was just to, you know, survive and, you know, get off Japan and back to Europe, you know, with riches in hand and whatnot. And so, yeah, so this is his arc complete of just being like, no, I'm going to stay here.
Yeah. Okay, one more question. When he is screaming at Torunaga that he has, like, been feeding him shit the whole time, is that a reference to when he, that like really arresting scene where he's laying out what the Portuguese want and that the Portuguese and the Spanish have divided the world and they're like, this belongs to you? And like, Torunaga was like, did he say belongs? Like, is that bullshit then? Is that like, because we only see really the religious conquest attempts, not really the political on behalf of the Portuguese.
Mm-hmm. Oh, just you mean like, oh, you mean with Blackthorn? I mean,
lying that like this is the Portuguese, like that they have a whole charter of like the world is divided between us and you? And
no, I thought that was just more of like him and kind of, you know, his intentions on, I guess, on behalf of, you know, essentially like England or the other like European powers in order to kind of like take, you know, it just basically compete for Portuguese power, like within this, this region. That would be my better guess at it.
Right. Okay. Interesting. Yeah. So I think that kind of brings us to the end of Shogun. The only thing I really want to note, well, okay, two things, sorry. The way Torunaga flicks his blade when, after he has beheaded Yabushige, is like the iciest thing I've ever seen in my life. And it's probably just how samurai did it, but to me it's just like, all right, slaughtered that cow, you know. Whatever.
So Hiroyuki has like essentially like training in this. It's why he always gets like these like type of roles
he's played Tokugawa before, right?
Oh yeah, I guess, yeah, I don't know specifically.
I think I looked at his Wikipedia.
Yeah.
Spent a lot of time on Wikipedia with the show.
Right, yeah, of course. Yeah, I mean, I just, you know, we've seen him in so many things over the years with, you know, like the Westworld stuff and even like John Wick and you know, other various things where he's just, you know, he plays the sword fighting Japanese man.
Yeah. And the other thing I want to say is that there are a lot of tonsures in this show and they're all awful. But none is quite as awful as Father Alvito's.
Is there a good tonsure? I mean, define a bad tonsure.
They look rather bizarre to me, but the fact that like Alvito just has this like very thick fringe of hair ringing around his head, like he looks fine when he's wearing a hat. And then it's just like, what is going on? Like, what is this? How is this real? like we're talking about bad cultural choices, like let's do this, you know. Anyway, that is Shogun, and I guess, you know, a lot of places, networks are scrambling for their version of Shogun, and what I have to say is pay attention to the stuff that actually made it work and not the stuff that it looked like made it work, like the Game of Thrones comparisons and stuff like that. I mean, not that that stuff's not valuable and cool, but it's the attention to historical detail. It's the honor it gives its characters, you know, it's the willingness to sit in scenes that makes this successful, in my opinion.
Couldn't agree more.
All right. So that will wrap up this discussion.
Well, thank you so much for showrunning this episode. And
my pleasure.
Hopefully we'll get something equally phenomenal to watch in the balance of the year and we can VOC again. I cannot communicate because my team that was 3-0 up needs to win this to win the league. It's the North London Derby. It's our biggest match of the season. Is now has conceded 2 stupid goals. We're in the 93rd minute of 6 minutes of added time. And if we concede a goal in the next 3 minutes, we're not going to win the league. So come back to me in 3 minutes and I will tell
you. Okay. Oh my gosh.
My heart rate is currently 96 BPM and it's typically in the 50s. So it's not a good time. Bye.
Good luck. Oh my gosh. Okay.
Always House of the Dragon.
I'm so excited. I'm sorry. I don't care. I'm so excited. I love season one. I'm so excited for season two.
Yeah, do you know when the next Rings of Power is coming? Speaking of also runs and not quite as good stuff.
I don't think it's this year.
Just low-key cancelled. Do you think we'll ever see it? I mean, they might not admit it, but do you think that's just going to be that?
I think season two will come out because they filmed it.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, I guess, yeah, Wikipedia claims it's coming out this year, but there's no set date for it.
Yeah, I don't know. Amazon is like, I mean, they must be very pleased with Fallout because, yeah. Fallout is Amazon, right? Because otherwise, yeah. Like, a lot of their big swings have not hit.
But it just feels even good stuff just goes there to die. I mean, Expats was phenomenal and no one talked about it. It just feels like even if it's good, it's just... The algorithm doesn't kind of promote it to enough people and it just doesn't get buzzworthy. And yeah. I don't know. It just feels even good shows. Like Mr. and Mrs. Smith was a good show. That just sort of,
yeah.
I don't know. Stuff just goes there to die. It really does.
Yeah. I mean, granted, I feel like it's been happening all the time with streaming services. Like what hits and what doesn't. And it's just like plenty of good stuff. I just feel
that's why no one's making anything anymore.
The Netflix algorithm will put stuff that's truly niche and get it in front of eyeballs, right? Like Baby Reindeer phenomenon, like this very niche, very indie, low budget British thing. Like the only way that's a worldwide hype show is because the algorithm just got it in front of enough people and pestered you to watch it.
Oh yeah, that is fair. Yeah.
Do people not people will just hang out on Netflix and like poke around? Maybe people don't do that on Amazon.
Yeah, I mean I think they don't do that on, you know, any other streaming service as much as they do Netflix. I mean that you know, as much as, you know, we can decry Netflix, like they they always have had like the best, like, you know, actual in terms of, you know, just kind of how it's designed and how it performs. Like that's like the main thing they got right, and no one else has been able to do it as well, at least in my opinion. So
my theory of why Netflix can do that is because it's only selling its own stuff. Whereas if you go to Amazon or Apple TV or Amazon, they're landing pages for so many bolt-on channels. And so it all gets muddied. Whereas because Netflix is pure focus, it is only pimping out its own content. And therefore, it is just going to badge you. Whereas, you know, I go to the homepage of my Fire Stick or Apple TV and there's so much crap that's nothing to do with Apple. So to find that big hit show is actually quite hard work.
Yeah.
And yet I feel that recently Apple TV has just come out with banger after banger and it used to be my least favorite of the streamers. So I don't know.
Well, we'll see when Severance ever comes back, like, which is, I've heard, another cursed production.
Yeah.
That should argue it being a one and done though.
Oh, I don't know. I'm in.
I want more though.
that show gave me like watching Lost feels that I haven't had in a really, really long time.
Yeah, but we all know how that ended up, right? So
that's true. It's true. I don't know. We'll see. We'll see. I think season two will be a real test of its durability.
For sure. Yeah.
Yeah.